Well, good afternoon, and thank you very much. You've got a great country, and yes, I've only got the Ontario version so far, but don't worry, I'll be back. I did come early. I needed a rest from my job, and I've had a bit of an opportunity to see some of the sites, well, just in Ontario. So I think we've had some great presentations. They've all been great. I don't know about you, but I've learned something from every one of them. I particularly liked, and I've forgotten, and my apologies to the other presenters. It's about 4 or 5 in the morning at home, so I should be deep asleep. So there's no excuse for all of you. I know it's after lunch, but stay on top of it. I particularly liked it when there was the example given about the processes, about competency and training. It's all very well for a producer to guarantee around auditing and compliance, but that comparison about the night shift and the new workers going in, the old workers. Well, I've been in my industry for quite some time now, many years, and so I'm one of those old workers who sometimes thinks I know it all. So coming here has been really good about getting a bit of a shake up and going home with some fresh ideas. I really liked David Smith's "Trust Me, It Doesn't Wash Anymore." And in my country, that is particularly true. And I hope my presentation will go some way to explain to you why that is so. I certainly get trust, you must trust but verify. Without documentation, it is only just a rumour. And without measurability, and I'm going to change the word here so that when I'm back home, they'll understand what I'm saying, it's just ticking a box. And definitely codes and auditing, they're a means to an end, but they're not the end. And sometimes it's a little hard for producers to understand that there's this fear that, you know, well, you've done it at this level, you've raised the bar so far, that means we're going to have to give more away the next time. Well, actually, that's true. But, you know, the market isn't static, time isn't static, things move on. And you either get where the market and your consumers are going, and you think about what your future is going to be, and you take control of it. And as Jeff from SPCA, we have our SPCA at home, said, your codes are your framework, and they're a great starting point. So I think I just pressed the green button, is that right? Okay. So I'm just going to give you a very quick overview of comparison between Australia and Canada. Then I'm going to go and talk about our model code and regulations on animal welfare, just particularly about the pig code, the market demands and complexities in Australia, and why we've moved to what we call, as my presentation heading said, shaping our future. And that's about ensuring our social license to continue to operate. And then why is differentiating Australian pork so important to that strategy and so important to the code? All right. So Canada's obviously a lot bigger, but we're fairly big ourselves. Distance, you know, it took me about as long to fly from Vancouver to Toronto as it does to go from Sydney to Perth. So, you have slightly more in population. We're at 22 million, you're 34 million. Our domestic consumption for pork, very similar. We have a lot of imports, very similar to you. Your domestic consumption of imports, the disappearance of pork in that market, very similar to the issues that we've been facing. However, your exports, I mean, they're just fantastic. You've built your industry on exports. We're a very small industry in my country. We're really small, which means that we have to be creative, innovative, and leverage our ideas off bigger industries. We often lead the way, and we get them to follow, and we make it their idea. We only slaughter 4.6 million compared to something like 21 million, and my apologies if these figures are slightly wrong, but you'll get the idea. That's just a production system overview. I won't go through that. It's very hog, or very pig, as we say, specific. So let me talk about the animal welfare and the model code regulations. We have at home a very similar process around the model code, although we have recently renamed it the standards and guidelines process. It was just a rebadging, really, but there you go. So, in Australia, under our constitution, it is the federal government that has responsibility for the model code process, for getting it going. And it also has responsibility for live exports, and that's where its responsibility ends. Thereafter, it's each state and territory is responsible for its own animal welfare legislation. And they reference the codes in slightly different ways, depending on the states. It's usually either as the code as a whole, which is my preference, and I'll explain that later. And it's usually under some form of protection for welfare of animal legislation that's already existing. States are very reluctant to modify their legislation anyway or introduce new legislation. It takes many, many years to get that through. Well, the code standards, so the standards that are written in the code, these are the musts, are specifically regulated, which can be a problem in itself because then the drafters get involved and they don't like certain words that you use, or they think, well, that doesn't sound so good, we'll just change that, tweak this here, and they come up with an entirely different standard, which is impractical to use on farm. Now, the model code for pigs was last reviewed in 2007. These reviews are supposed to be undertaken every 5 years, although the Australian government with the livestock industries will go through and prioritise which ones are the most important and should be done sooner or later. Now, my industry's actual preparation for that code began in 2002-2003. We then had to ask the government if would they mind delaying because we were in the middle of a huge drought and you don't want to be going out and consulting with your producers when they've got some fairly genuine concerns in other areas. So the consultation process actually started in 2004. A writing committee was formed. We were part of that writing committee, as were the regulators in each state, vets. The RSPCA and another animal welfare body, well, actually, I call it an animal rights body, Animals Australia. And I like to make a distinction here. When we talk at home, we talk about animal welfare bodies, which I'd put your SCA in, and our RSPCA at home. And then we have our animal rights groups, such as Animals Australia, which really their remit is about a meat-free world. And so their agendas and the way they operate are very different. And their business strategies are different, and it's very important to understand that so that when you're in discussion, engagement, negotiating, you know where they're coming from. Because you can still collaborate at times with these bodies, and later in the presentation I'll explain how that can occur. So the co-process was quite long, and it always is long for an intensive industry. It was signed off by our Primary Industries Ministerial Council, that's a collection of the state and federal agricultural ministers, in 2007. There were 25 key changes made, most significant of which are around space allowance increases, and they had a defined time in which they'd be introduced, and those dates are there. A six-week limit on the use of sow stalls, which would come into effect in 2017, and most importantly, stock person training competency assessment and verification had to be introduced by 2011. That was very important. And part of the negotiations, and always the welfare groups would say, well, how do we know that you're doing this? You need to verify, you need to show compliance, which was a reasonable question. But in particular, they were focusing on stock person competency because I think any farmer will know that you can have a pig in a pig palace. If you don't have good stock people, you're not going to produce a good welfare outcome for that animal. That particular piece of change has had ramifications across to other livestock industries in their code negotiations. And that's why it's always important to pay attention to what's going on in other industries around you, because what they do can affect the way you farm or your farming practices. Now, the standards that was agreed by Primary Industry Ministerial Council had to be regulated in all states by April 2009. Now, I've got to tell you, this has been one of the longest parts of the process that I've ever been part of, and I'll show you a slide around this in a minute. Now, when this code was started, it was everybody funded themselves. The states funded themselves, the Commonwealth government funded itself, and the industry body funded itself. Now, I've estimated that between the start of that code and the time that it's been implemented, we as an industry body have spent close to $400 million defending our position. And that excludes the R&D part of it. It's expensive. Nevertheless, the code has been viewed as an industry success. It was forward-thinking at its time and proactive, but I'm sitting in 2011, and I've got to tell you, things have changed quite a lot in the last 18 months. But at the time, very forward-thinking and proactive. It avoided downside in timing of changes for space requirements, impacts of further reduction in sow stall usage. So we were actually facing that code, no stall use pressures, and also the four-week limit use that's required by the EU. And as I said, it set a precedent for other livestock codes. We pushed as an industry, and this was a first, that the standards, the musts, must be regulated in each state. We wanted protection. Now, I know that I've heard Catherine say, well, you know, you don't want to go that way. And maybe that's very true for Canada, and I'm in no position to state that. But in terms of what was happening in my own country, we wanted that protection. We wanted to have defence, because we get a lot of farm raids, and we want to be able to show we're doing the right thing to the courts. We set also a framework for what became the new standards and guidelines process. Now, since that time, 72% of production in Australia use sow stalls now for just up to 4 weeks. And about another half of that 70% are only actually using stalls for up to 2 weeks. So we're actually doing better than the code. And it's a great result, but it's still not enough. And I'll get to why in a minute. So here we see, this is the process around state regulation of the pig code. So the pig code at this point had been signed off year zero. And as you see, it shows which states actually started to put it into regulations. South Australia was first off, very proactive state. They got a little bit of it wrong, but that's okay. They don't make a fuss about it. They'll go back and change it, and that's good, and they consult with us. New South Wales was also very good in the process. Western Australia, well, they decided they needed to make it a little bit harder. I've missed Queensland in there. So Queensland actually, it only finished its regulations in December last year. Tasmania is yet to regulate. And Tasmania, so that's our island at the bottom. The Greens, the Green political party there, it dominates. So anything socially, that has a social issue around it, it's big news there. And they decided that they were going to enforce their sovereign right as a state to go for a higher welfare standard. And this was despite the fact that their minister signed off and agreed to the code. So there's no surety in this process either. But that's just, for me, in many ways, dealing with the government is like dealing with markets. And when this happened to us, it was, you know, we tried to bring it to the attention of the livestock industries, and particularly the red meat sector, because it is so big in Australia, and if we can get their support, that's fantastic. But I have to say, the extensive industries have always been lagging behind on welfare. They've been in a very comfortable position, and I don't think they feel so comfortable now after the live export issue. There is a problem when states start to tweak codes because pig producers trade across borders, you get different outcomes, and it does tend to be slightly anti-competitive in terms of business, and we try to point this out to the states. This is actually our standard guideline process about the various committees. All you really need to know is that we have a special reference group that's established and a writing group, and it has specific membership, which includes the RSPCA and Animals Australia. The funding, well, since the pig code, it's been agreed that it's going to be a third from each party. So the federal government pays a third, the state governments pay a third, and the industry pays a third. If you're a small industry, the costs are a lot less, and also there's a lot more consideration as to how you might fund. There mightn't be the same expectation. It has to, any code before it can go out for public consultation goes to one of the Office of Best Practice Regulation. That's where they do a regulatory impact statement to make sure that it's not going to be at a greater cost to the taxpayer and it has the public benefit, etc. After that, it goes out for public consultation. And then once it's got through all that, comes back to the reference group, gets signed off, it then gets presented to the various government committees that finally makes its way up to the primary industry ministerial council. In that process, it's supposed to be that if there's any change, it has to come back to the reference group for sign-off to give it some surety. And as I said, that's when the states then go to implement the code on the ground. But as I've just said, Tasmania, they've all actually reserved their sovereign right to enact a higher welfare standard. Now, in principle, they'll say it should be the same outcome, but they won't actually commit fully to that. And that actually has become a very, very big problem for us at home, and one that's always top of the agenda in discussions with the livestock industries and the various committees. And I think we're making headway, and that's a good thing. You just need a lot of patience and tolerance. Now, also from the pig code, there has been a move for an increasing role of industry QA to show you're demonstrating that you're actually doing what you say you're doing and a verification of that. And we actually tried to get out a quality assurance program recognised in the pig code in 2007. The regulators go, oh no, we can't do that, we can't do that. Would have been great help to us. And also goes down to the questions that have been asked here around compliance. But we've gone ahead anyway with our APIC program, our quality assurance program, because we believe it is important to show that you're actually saying what you're doing, or doing what you're saying, sorry. So I just very briefly talk about at the Australian Pork Industry Quality Assurance Program. Now, the farms are independently audited by a third party. I just want to step back. The Canadian Quality Assurance Program is very similar to what APIC was several years ago, which started just as a food safety program, and since then it's modified. One of the speakers said earlier that it's really important that you learn to walk first before you run, that's very, very true. So I'm showing you some end results of where we've ended up, but it's always evolving. You need to embed a culture first around quality assurance, then you can go into an auditing process. Then it might be a third-party auditing process. Now, ours is third-party because we need to show particular compliance to some of our customers. We also do we invite a third party in to do an audit of the actual program itself that we administer and manage by third party to give us a report card. The APIC covers food safety, biosecurity, traceability and animal welfare. It's voluntary, and it is voluntary. No one's going to make you do it, but if your customers want it, well, that's their choice, and it's your choice whether you're going to supply that market. APIC certification is required, though, by most of our major processing establishments and by the major retailers, which is great. Also, three of our big processing establishments have now, over the last 12 months, announced that they will discount your pigs if you don't have APIC or a quality assurance program they approve of. So you're not going to get a premium for it, but it's now that you'll get your pigs will be discounted. The Victorian Livestock Management Act, I just wanted to briefly talk about this because this is an innovative piece of legislation and I'm hoping that other states will pick it up. South Australia's shown some interest in it. And why is it innovative? Because it recognises industry compliance programs. And what it says is that it's just a new piece of legislation that's come in. So all producers must undertake a systematic risk assessment with regard to animal welfare, biosecurity, traceability, food safety. And you must do that within 6 months of the standards coming into effect. You are, however, exempt if you are in an approved compliance program. And an approved compliance program is one such as APIC. So I'm actually getting APIC reviewed by the Victorian government and approved as one such program. The objective here is to minimise regulatory burden by using QA programs to demonstrate compliance. It gives assurance to the regulators. My producers are exempt from random inspections because they have proof that they're doing the right thing. And I'm in negotiations with the Victorian government around what kind of demonstration in terms of record-keeping summary reports that they need. However, as I mentioned earlier, the market has changed. So we had a very progressive model code, one that my producers were very, very proud of, and they still like to mention. But we've gone past the six-week limit use. And why, as some of the maple leaf guys said, why would you do such a crazy thing as this? To pursue the voluntary phasing out of sow stalls. Not talking about limiting their use, they're going out of production. Well, I need to explain to you why. So whenever you're looking at a country, you really need to understand the market dynamics and complexities that are operating there. Because I hope when I finish this, you'll understand why and see it as a very sensible decision. We started with the premise that the use of gestation stalls will at some point in the future be unacceptable to the community and their use will be forced to cease. This will be realised through both regulations and market forces via our retailers. Now, there's pressure points for mounting political and social change. I think you know most of these. The affluent society, its growing importance of welfare. There's an increasing public opposition to close confinement systems in intensive production. There's community concern about intensive farming, a lot more around intensive farming than I'd say extensive farming. There's a growing city and country divide. We have our animal welfare groups and animal rights group and their growing prominence in both the media and their use of social media. There's the politics involved too, because you just can't divorce the two. There's the populist view that always tends to hold, and in my country it's about who holds the balance of power right now, because that dynamic's changed. Now, we're seeing global influences being reflected locally. You heard about California's Proposition 2, and actually that has been moving across the US. Smithfield's announced its intentions around sow stalls a few years ago. The New Zealand pork industry, which is right on my doorstep, announced that it was going to ban sow stalls, and then you have the UK and EU positions. We have a great deal of retailer pressure, and I'll explain why that's important. They want products with a high perceived values of welfare at a much lower price. They also want welfare-friendly products that are supported by robust standards, and they want us to show them. They want proof that that's exactly what that product is. And in Australia, we see the emergence of animal law, and this is particularly through the growth of one particular group, Voiceless. It's growing rapidly and it is highly regarded, almost Not it, its brand is in terms of the RSPCA is not as high, but it moves in the financial institution circles. It has the ear of one of our retired justices, well regarded. They have people like Jane Goodall as their patrons. I mean, they have a list of high profile patrons. They are clever, they're strategic. They're greatly admired in what they're doing and where they're targeting, and they are of great concern to me. Now, I'm going to... I just want to talk to you a little bit about animal welfare groups, because when I came here, I rather naively thought that the pressures that were being experienced in the US were also being experienced here, but that doesn't seem to be playing out. You seem to have a very conservative or quiet period around your animal welfare, animal rights groups. Now, that might stay like that for you forever. I don't know. What I do know is you should always be thinking forward and you shouldn't be complacent around it. Where you are right now reminds me of where we were about 5 years ago, and I would have been thinking the same thing about our animal welfare and animal rights groups, and I would have been thinking, oh, Australians are too pragmatic to get involved in this kind of thing. And the RSPCA, it's been doing a great job. Well, I've got to tell you, on the live export issue, the RSPCA moved to such an extent it shocked the red meat industry. It shocked the cattle industry. How could the RSPCA betray us like this? How could they collaborate with Animals Australia? Well, they took their eye off the game. They didn't bother to consider the business plan of the RSPCA. And if they knew them well enough, they knew that they were always opposed to live exports. And for them, they wanted to make themselves... they wanted to effect change. They were tired of being the middle road, of always being agreeable and working. They wanted to effect real change and they wanted to show that. So you can collaborate with people you don't necessarily agree with, but you're seeking the same outcome. Eventually they'll part company, but they'll come together on other issues again. And they both have an extensive funding base. And it's just a business strategy. So the campaigns at home have become over time more sophisticated, incredibly targeted. They use an impressive use of social media. I mean, I heard them, I think it was your Director General yesterday talking about 1,000 ministers. Well, that's over governance, isn't it? 1,000 letters to the minister. Well, that's nothing. When they get going and they use social media and it's just one easy click of the button, you have letters going everywhere to your major retailers, to your local retailer, to your local Member of Parliament, to the Minister for Agriculture. And it's all just one click of the button. Their use of blogging, Twittering, impressive, really impressive. And I wish I had that kind of money, but I don't. But also they have the luxury of investment. They only need to focus on one issue, whereas farming bodies need to focus on many issues and expend their money wisely. And what I've seen in the last couple of years is multimillionaire financial backers of animal rights groups such as Animals Australia and Voiceless, which enables them to run these kind of campaigns. The NGOs are not scared of taking risks, and farmers tend to be a little bit more cautious. And they are very strategic, they are patient, and they are committed to their cause. So you shouldn't underestimate them. I'm just going to show you one of their latest rounds of ads. So that was just one. They've just been getting better and better. And go and have a look at their website. It's really good. So, as I mentioned, they've become collaborative in their campaigns. Animal rights and the use of social media has been incredibly impressive. Their effective messaging and, as I said, the capacity of our livestock owners to respond is very limited. And there's this growing disconnect between the rural and city divide, which fuels this even more. And I've talked about the sophisticated wealth funds and live export issue. It's changed the paradigm again. And it's another message about watch what other livestock industries are doing, because the cattle industry's not only just changed the paradigm, they've got the minister involved. This is a big win for the animal rights movement. They got the attention of our minister, who closed that market based on the fact of such vehement public response that they were so the abhorrence of what was happening in Indonesia. So that just means that when they campaign against us next time, they know if they can get the message right, they can continue that sustained campaign, that they can affect the change at a ministerial level, a government level. So the city-country divide in Australia, it's really changing, but I think most the important thing there is it's driving generational changes in the community awareness and attitudes and behaviour towards welfare, farming and food production. It's a really hard one to broach. Also, around this time, we got another big 60 Minutes story playing out. We didn't come across that very well at all. It's very hard. That's sensational media. They love bad stories, and it's hard to put across that you're doing the right thing at those times. So even though we've been proactive, an APIC program, you know, you'd have to wonder, why don't we just give up? Just give up right now. But it's not like that. It's little steps along the way. Just as they're patient and committed, you also have to be very patient, committed and strategic. The board had been discussing the use of sow stalls for some time. The 60 Minutes debate just started to heat it up a whole lot more at a board level. The board decided it wanted to go out and have a look at some research on consumers, retailers and producers, and they commissioned that. Now, any campaign we've tracked does have an impact on pork sales, but only for 3 weeks. As far as I know, the live export issue, but I haven't had an MLA confirm this, saw a drop for about 6 weeks. But just imagine if you can sustain a campaign long enough, the changes that you can make. Now, we also wanted to know from consumers, what did they want to know? Well, in fact, they just want information. And by the way, it's not just the information, it's the way you deliver the information. They don't want you tearing down, well, in Australia, tearing down the animal rights, animal welfare groups. Doesn't help your cause. Most of them are receptive to industry information. But you've got to be out there selling that. They're selling it in the marketplace. You've got to tell people what you're going to do. You've got to show your compliance. And you've also got to be ready to move when they do mount these types of campaigns. The most important thing for us was around retailers' findings, and this was all done in 2009, so it was well and truly on the radar, pig welfare. The larger retailers were really very sensitised to it. We were seen as generally responsive and proactive on many issues, but what the retailers wanted from us, they wanted us to be proactive and show leadership on animal welfare and make some of the hard decisions. Just to let you know about the politics, that's really important. The Greens and Independents hold the balance of power in Australia. The Greens have a stated policy to phase out intensive farming practices. Pretty hard to deal with that. The politics tend in Australia. Australia is one of the most urbanised countries in the world. Most people live down the east coast of Australia in the major metropolitan cities. And so politics in Australia tends to focus on metropolitan and marginal seats. In times of animal welfare issues, we tend to get knee-jerk reactions, which can have unintended consequences. And that's really important. And in June 2010, despite our discussions with the Tasmanian government about what we were doing, we're having these industry consultations about thinking about banning sow stalls or voluntary moving out of sow stalls, the Tasmanian government decided it was going to ban them themselves. That's good on Tasmania. Thanks God it's small. You know, my only saving grace in Tasmania is the fact I only have a handful of producers there. They're niche producers. But the most amazing thing about Tasmania is though, even though they will ban the use of sow stalls sooner than what we will, and they'll do it through regulation. Now, we're arguing that this has to be a voluntary movement. We've gone out and persuaded governments, we don't want you regulating here. We will do it as an industry. We know what's best for our industry. We just need some support from you and the retailers to get there. And this is... So what will happen is they'll just move live pigs across the Bass Strait or product across the Bass Strait to Tasmania. So they're just going to drive the existing producers out of business there. And they're not going to have addressed the welfare issue that they want to address. It's not a win-win. And it's a short-sighted policy. All right, so we have mounting pressure for change in Australia. We've got our largest pork producers. So something like the top 30 produce over 50% of production. The top 5-6 are already moving into South Stall-free production. And they're on target to meet it by 2014. The message from the retail and consumers group. So Coles was leading the push for fresh pork in terms of sales stores for fresh pork, and then they extended that to processed pork for their home-branded product. And that was a win for us because their home-brand product consists mostly of imports. The Tasmanian stall issue, New Zealand pork code by then had decided it was also going to ban sales stalls. And the standards and guidelines for my own industry is now scheduled for a 2015 review. The state and federal governments have become very sensitised to animal welfare. The welfare lobby is significant and having an impact. And as an industry, we prefer to be proactive rather than reactive. We want to set our own agenda. We don't want it to have to be set for us. And we want to secure our social licence to continue to operate. So the board decided that we were going to shape our own future and we were going to set the agenda, and we launched an industry consultation process to investigate our position on gestation stalls while also addressing issues around imports, labelling and labour issues. Now, the premise is that that we would actually be better off but to improve our government relations, actively differentiate Australian pork product from imports. We need to create a consistent and logical standards around a withdrawal. And wouldn't it be better for us to be in a position to leverage our government and retailer support and also gain the support of the welfare and animal rights lobby groups for Australian product? So you can collaborate. You just need to pick the ones that you can collaborate on. That's just a consultation process that happened last year over June to November. Now, in the consultation, there were some big issues for producers. They were really concerned about the extra cost that they might have to endure in terms of capital and labour investment, and that this would put them in a further disadvantage to, well, more for them, imports. The rising tide of cheap imported pork meat into Australia, it's massive. They're also concerned that imported pig meat doesn't have to meet the same standards that they have to, that most of the labelling in Australia around meat and processed meat is misinformation, and a perceived lack of clarity around country of origin labelling. Now, just want to show you what pork consumption looks like in Australia, and I think the blue is exports, pink is imports, so you can see that's been rising, and that's the green is the total apparent consumption. Now, in terms of per capita, the fresh pork consumption is 8.8 kilograms, and Australian Pork Limited has been focusing its strategy around fresh pork consumption. Some years ago, it made a decision around, well, it wouldn't be focusing too much on imported pork. It's recognised as a bad decision now. But that doesn't mean we can't regain some of our ground. Now, processed is 15.2 kilograms. We love our ham, we love our bacon, we love our processed product. But 10.2 of that is imported product. So I say to an Australian, every time you open your fridge, you pull out that piece of bacon, 70% of that is imported product. You're sending money offshore. If you're so concerned about welfare, you should be looking for the right label. But what label is that? Because that's been a big issue in my country too. There's no way. My industry is so small that we can compete on price with the likes of you, the USA, Canada, US, Brazil, there isn't. So we've had to define a strategy around other things. We also did a cost estimate around the how much would it cost to change from a stall to a group environment. And it was estimated, depending on your size of production, around 783 to 1,500 stall space. And our dollar is about the same as your dollar at the moment. So it was a big capital investment. The total capital investment to the industry is at least $50 million. You know, my government threw $100 million at the red meat industry because of the live exports. It will be interesting to see how they will reward an industry that has been proactive. And we're about to go into negotiations around that. So we took this decision to our delegates, who are representative of the pork industry. These are just, you know, we'll pursue the voluntary phasing out of sow stores. We'll recognise the commitments we need in offsets help us make this change. And it is only a voluntary commitment. We do need the consumers, the retailers and government support to effect this change, and we've made that very clear. We had overwhelming support. 83% of the production voted, yes, we're going to do this. And as far as we know, this is a world first for an industry body. So we've gone into shaping our future stage two objectives. So we have an implementation plan around this, about seeking support for gestation store-free definition. We need to achieve our trade-offs, and I'll show you quickly what they are. We need to ensure our capacity and capability to change by 2017, and the Australian fresh and processed pork differentiate from imports at a processor and retailer level. They're the trade-offs. They're around structural assistance, labour supply skills and extension, standards and guidelines process, marketing support, retailer processes. I could speak all day about this, but you can go onto the website. All the presentations will be loaded up, and it's quite detailed plans behind this, with timelines and what has to be achieved. Now, I mentioned Coles because Coles had moved to... they will not accept a product that is produced from our stalls. When they first came out with that announcement, and we had been in discussion with them around this and told them what we were planning to do, but we're just consulting, they decided they wanted to move a lot quicker for their own reasons. We then mounted a campaign and said, you need to extend this to your processed product as well. You can't have a dual policy. I mean, they came back and said, well, consumers, you know, they're only concerned about fresh pork. Well, no, that's not true. They're concerned about every type of pork. So we've now started a campaign around differentiating Australian pork. Small goods sector, just to quickly let you know, $500 million is sent offshore every year. And a lot of it makes its way here. Our inadequate labelling and country of origin laws. The campaign's built around making sure we can differentiate Australian pork. So we sign up licensees in the process market that will only use Australian pork. It's audited to verify compliance. In Australia, you can use product of Australia, made in Australia. Made in Australia just literally means it's mostly imported pork, but Australians think they're doing the right thing because it's made in Australia. I mean, you really got to read the fine print on labelling, and I don't know many consumers who take the time to do that. But what we've done is we've said that little lovely little Australian pork mark that gets branded on everything, look for that mark. That will tell you that you're consuming 100% Australian pork. The other part of this strategy is around our high-integrity Australian pork. I seem to have missed there was a great slide here that explained the retail market. Do you know where that... It's gone. I should explain to you the retail market. Why is the retail market so important? It's 70% of that market is dominated by two supermarket chains, Woolworths and Coles, and they dictate the policy, around 70 to 80%. Also, the processing market is dominated by two processors at 80% of the market. They wield enormous power. And so we work very hard with our retailers, those two retailers, to make sure that we're moving in the direction they need us to move, because they reflect what our consumers want. Now, part of getting us to a sow store-free environment, at least cost to our producers, is going to occur through our high-integrity Australian pork CRC. This was one of only four. There were 30 bids that went up for a CRC. They come up every year. It's very competitive. It goes right across the sectors. Could be industrial, etc. Only four bids got up last year. We were the only agriculture bid that got up. It's a whole of chain support CRC. We have industry and university and government contributing. We also have the RSPCA as a participant, core participant. We have one of our major retailers as a participant, and we have nine international participants. Now, it's the outcome. What we want to do is produce a high quality pork for the same financial cost, but without the collateral cost that impacts on animal and social welfare, the production environment, or the health and well-being of the consumer, the ultimate in local and global food security. The CRC has 7 years in which to deliver this, and it'll do in terms of the welfare area. It's looking at confinement-free sows and piglet management, efficient and ethical production without the need for sow confinement in stalls or crates, or reduced use of antibiotic medications. Now, it's focusing around weaning systems, housing and management systems, mating and lactation, and also new confinement-free farrowing systems. And when I left Australia, I became aware that Voiceless was about to mount another campaign. And they were doing that in collaboration with Animals Australia. And this campaign is focusing on the fact that they want us to move out of sow stalls even faster than what we've committed to do. When I get home, one of my first meetings is going to be, we've already had a meeting with the RSPCA, my next meeting is going to be with Voiceless around what they're doing and what they're planning to do. And we'll be talking to them about, well, we should be working together on this, because if you want us to move faster, what we need from you is we need you to come with us to the minister. We need you to be our voice with the people around consuming Australian product, making sure that we get the assistance that we need to retrofit our stores, that we get all the state governments online in terms of environmental planning and consent for licensing of those new retrofits. Those refits. So you can collaborate with these groups, you just need to pick the issues. I think we're in a much better position than we ever were in terms of we've been forward thinking around this. We've built understanding of what we have in common with these, with the welfare groups and rights group, and what is different. So it'll be interesting to see, watch this space in the next 3 months, and really over the next 2 years to see what kind of effect we're going to make. So, any questions? And we do farm those, but this one's out doing a little farming of its own. And just if you want some more information, it'll all be at the end of the slide.
Well, first of all, thank you.
Thank you. Ron Maynard. I don't understand your concern about live exports. That maybe I'm just not in the loop, but I don't, where your export. We're at a very low level. I don't see the controversy. Okay. Maybe I don't understand the problem, but just to expand on
it. I should have put that in context for you. There was, do any of you know about the live export issue in Australia that involved the red meat industry? Okay. The cattle industry does a lot of live export, as does the sheep meat industry. This particular issue is about live exports of cattle going into Indonesia. The group Animals Australia loves to go overseas, it's done it with the sheep meat industry, into those export markets, into those establishments and take footage. They worked with one of our Australian, the ABC in Australia, very credible, around exposing the mistreatment of animals. You can look at it on YouTube, and I have seen the footage, and it's pretty horrific. It was awful. But then, you know, they always take the worst. And there's a Senate inquiry going on at the moment, and there's been questions asked about the credibility of the ABC. Why didn't they go in and take their own footage? It was showing the worst of the worst. It shows 6 of 11 processing establishments. This isn't my industry. This is the cattle industry. But it never showed the other ones. It never showed the ones that were doing the good things. the right things. Was there room for improvement? Yes, there is. But this is the thing about unintended consequences. This is a great example. I think it was a bit of a knee-jerk reaction from my government. He immediately, our minister, banned live exports into Indonesia, which I think for the Indonesians must have been pretty insulting and very colonial of us, because there wasn't really any dialogue going on. We have tense relations with Indonesia. The other thing you need to realise about Indonesia, 280 million people, I think. It's the largest Muslim state, a nation outside of the Middle East. They have different culture, different practice, a different way of buying meat at markets. MLA had been putting a lot of R&D and investment in that area. I don't know a lot about it. I do think they could have been doing a better job. Anyway, that's for them to sort out. The reason it had unintended consequences too, because in terms of, as soon as they stopped that export, those cattle in the north had nowhere to go. They'd all been mustered out of the Northern Territory in Queensland, big spaces, into these yards, ready to be transported up and exported out. They had nowhere to go. These stock were purely bred for that market in Indonesia. They didn't meet the domestic requirements. There was a lot of discussion around, should they be transported down south? Well, that's a long route. I don't think that's a great welfare outcome either. And also then there's the price impact on the southern markets. The transport industry was out of business. Stock people had to be put off. I mean, these were unintended consequences. I certainly think we should have had some suspension of trade. It needed to be investigated, but this had a big impact. But for where I see it from my industry, the biggest impact it had was the fact that an animal welfare and animal rights group had come together, had run a very, very successful campaign. I think they got about 40,000 when they were putting up a... 40,000 Australians had petitioned that, you know, they didn't accept this practice anymore. It stimulated a lot of great debate, I've got to say that. Really did, both at the livestock industry and the public issue, at the public level as well. But for where I sit, and as an intensive industry, we have been experiencing campaigns for some time. Any intensive industry in Australia has. We're quite well positioned. We're thinking ahead. We're trying to make sure that, you know, we're being proactive and showing leadership. But they've changed the dynamics for us because they've given the Animal Welfare and Animal Rights Group a huge success. They know that they can get the government to respond. So I hope that provided some explanation to that.
Hi, Sheila McDonald. I'm with the Canadian Federation of Humane Societies. I just wanted to ask a bit about what system the industry has moved towards when phasing out sow stalls. We hear a lot about aggression issues, and have you moved to straw-based and electronic feeding, and how have you addressed those issues in the industry?
Okay, so we're going to move over 2017. As I said, some producers, our big producers, are already almost there. It's a huge move, and it shouldn't never be taken lightly, because there are aggression issues. There's losses in productivity in the medium term. So farmers bear huge costs, and if, like Canada, the Canadian hog industry, coming out of a really difficult time, you don't have the financial resources in order to make that investment. If you want an industry to change, government and retailers need to be behind it every step of the way. Because all you're going to do is come out with a worse welfare outcome. That's all it will be. It has to be a very managed transition. And you need to make sure that your producers can afford to do this.
So are you using straw?
Well, that's a very simple question. If I was in a free-range system, yeah, fine, or if I was in an eco-shelter. But you've got to look at, when you're looking at this, where is most of your production? So I think 47% is ours in conventional. That means indoors, usually on slatted system. You can have group housing and good group housing there. But those systems have been built on effluent systems. You throw straw in there, you're just going to have an environmental catastrophe. So you've got to be realistic about the changes. You've got to balance them out. As I think Dave was saying, there's no sweet spot here. You've got to be careful around what can you practically do. And what I really like to see from the animal welfare and animal rights groups is, gee, you've done a great job. We're really proud that you've taken the leadership here, and we want to help you get there, because at the end of the day, we do have a common interest, the welfare of our animals.
It was answered.
Okay. Well, thank you.
Thank you very much.